I have equal aggravation with dumb sinners out there that want to come and capsulize the Christian ministry in a 30-second television spot, too. You know, there's some people think to be a Christian, you've got to cut the top of your head off. Look, Plato's peanuts alongside this. And I can handle Aristotle under my arm. Whitehead and Hegel and Karl Marx are kindergarten material alongside the Bible, rightly divided. Blind leading the blind, falling the ditch together, simple preaching, producing simpletons. Simply terrible. Now, as 6 years earned me, I've opened up God's book for 6 years, never gone past the verse of Scripture without explaining it. 6 years earned me the chance to pull your head sideways a little bit so we get ourselves out of traditional bondage. What's the matter with this stupid thing? It just keeps going one silly direction. Moreover, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, say now to the rebellious house, know ye not what these things mean? I wonder why that fellow that always gets a word from the Lord for everybody never ever has the Lord revealed to him when you're in trouble. A great eagle with great wings and many feathers, and behold, the vine did bend a root toward him. That means you ought to marry the guy, sister. That went by kind of fast. See, if you think about it, you got it. I have talked to everybody. I got an inside crowd out there that's watched it for years. That's why Ethel goes bananas once in a while. She's seen so much. She picks up things when I'm going down a trail. Some of you newcomers, thank God, you don't even pick up on, because you haven't seen some of the things we've seen. Say now to the rebellious house, know ye not what these things mean? Well, you dummy, don't you know what they mean? God expects you to know. Tell them. Tell them, Lord, tell me first. Behold, the king of Babylon has come to Jerusalem and hath taken the king thereof and the princes thereof and led them with him to Babylon. Okay, we know that's going to happen. Nebuchadnezzar is going to take Zedekiah, blind him, and take him to Babylon. Okay, that's part of the riddle, maybe. And hath taken of the king's seed and made a covenant with him. Which one? And hath taken an oath of him. He hath also taken the mighty of the land. Now we got to sort of pay attention to what the king of Babylon did with each of the kings. That the kingdom might not be base, that it might not lift itself up, but that by keeping of his covenant it might stand. But he rebelled against him. Now we know we're talking about the king that made a pact with Egypt. He rebelled against him in sending his ambassadors into Egypt. Now you read about that in Jeremiah. That they might give him horses and much people. Shall he prosper? Shall he escape that doeth such things? Or shall he break the covenant and be delivered? As I live, saith the Lord God, surely in the place where the king dwelleth that made him king, whose oath he despised, and whose covenant he brake, even with him in the midst of Babylon shall he die. Now we know that part of the riddle, if this is the interpretation of it, is fulfilled. Zedekiah, who gave an oath to the king of Babylon of what he would do, broke his word, made a pact with Egypt, and for breaking his word, going to die in Babylon. Neither shall Pharaoh with his mighty army and great company make for him in the war, but casting up mounts and building forts to cut off many persons, seeing he despised the oath of breaking the covenant, when, lo, he had given his hand and hath done all these things, he shall not escape. Therefore thus saith the Lord God, as I live, surely mine oath that he hath despised and my covenant that he hath broken, even it will I recompense upon his own head. And I will spread my net upon him, and he shall be taken in my snare, and I will bring him to Babylon. and will plead with him there for his trespass that he hath trespassed against me, and all his fugitives with all his bands shall fall by the sword, and they that remain, they won't all be killed, and they that remain shall be scattered toward all winds, and ye shall know that I the Lord have spoken it. So when Judah's king is going to be carried into bondage in Babylon and die there, and the rest of them who lean on the staff of Egypt are going to be destroyed except for a remnant that's going to be scattered. Where? Scattered toward all winds. Thus saith the Lord God, I will also take of the highest branch of the high cedar, back to the riddle, and will set it. I will crop off from the top of his young twigs a tender one. Now he's being very specific. From the top of these twigs, a tender one, and will plant it upon an high mountain and eminent. In the mountain of the height of Israel will I plant it. And it shall bring forth boughs and bear fruit and be a goodly cedar. And under it shall dwell all fowl of every wing, and the shadow of the branches thereof shall they dwell. And all the trees of the field shall know that I, the Lord, have brought down the high tree, have exalted the low tree, have dried up the green tree, and have made the dry tree to flourish. I, the Lord, have spoken and have done it. Where and what and with what and when? You understand that? You do. You're pretty smart. You know where that... Wait a minute, let's see. There are two eagles come. Now we know one of them crops off the top of his young twigs and takes the seed and plants it by great waters. We know another one comes, has got a her, and the her and the him get involved and get planted by great waters. Then he starts interpreting, but only interprets part of it. The only part he interprets, I'll tell you that much, is that that relates to the king of Babylon and Zedekiah and the destruction of those that go down to Egypt that don't die with him in Babylon, and the scattering of the small remnant that went down to Egypt. But doesn't interpret. He's back to riddle form when he talks about the twigs and the small tender one. How about that? That's why I say, can you imagine somebody laboring through the Bible in 72? Okay, kids, let's get around the breakfast table now. Today we have to read, because Brother Orr's got it in his little daily outfit. We've got to read Ezekiel 17. Now, once you go to school, understand about these twigs and tender plants and cedars and loppings and cuttings and plantings and furrows and great waters. One of my relatives said, he wants it understood, why didn't he? Have I earned the right to do this? Yes. Now, I've made some very complicated things simple. I got a little bit of track record. This is explainable. You say, well, you're going to explain it tonight? My lands, no. No, I'm going to explain it tonight. Now, why is this, you know where this started? Why is the history of Ireland a mystery? I mean, these people figured out who the sons of Saki is, and the British Israelites figured out about England. What about these Ireland people? Now, this is Celtic myth and legend by Charles Squire. He's not a Christian. He's no British Israelite. Now, the place is full of, this book is just full of the stuff about the Tuatha De Danann. Now, let's get over here and read from the camera so you can see. Now, this guy's a real scholar. Let's go right here. The enemies alike of Firbolg and Fomor The twelfth of the Dedanim, gods of the Gaels, were the next to arrive. He's given us the history of these early Irish people. I go back and say, the title, this chapter is entitled, The Gods Arrive, chapter 6. The people of the goddess Danu were not the first divine inhabitants of Ireland. Others had been before them, dwellers in the dark, backward in the abysm of time. In this, the Celtic mythology resembles those of other nations, in almost all of which we find an old, dim realm of gods standing behind the reigning pantheon. And he goes into their legends, which is his version of it. Talks about the firbolgs. Then he comes. I have one goal. I'm trying to show you that science is not as sure as they'd like to have you believe. And there's one certain rock on which to stand. God's word has survived the centuries and has never had to come up and say, hey, I apologize for this chapter, we'll have to take it out. The Gaels who held themselves to be the children of the light. Oh, let's go, let me see. Now, where you go with these people, you find uncertainty. Well, let's just take these people he's talking about on page 69. We have practically no other details regarding their life in Ireland. It's obvious, however, they were not really gods, but the pre-Aryan race, which the Gaels, when they landed in Ireland, found already in occupation. You're talking about the aboriginal background. They are many instances of people at a somewhat stage of culture regarding tribes in a somewhat lower one as semi-divine or rather half-diabolical. Boy, isn't that a bunch of semantical hogwash. I mean, what he should have said is, I don't know beans about them. But what he said was, I don't know beans about them in a very educational way. There are many instances of people at a certain stage of culture regarding tribes in a somewhat lower one as semi-divine or rather half-diabolical. Which is a somewhat statement of somewhat of nothing. The suspicion and fear with which the early Celts must have regarded the savage aborigines made them seem larger than human. They feared them for the weird magical rites they practiced in their inaccessible forts among the hills amid storms and mountain mists. The Gaels who held themselves to be the children of light deemed these dark Iberians children of the dark. Their tribal names seem to have been in several instances founded upon this idea. There were the name translates people of darkness and people of the night and sons of the dark. But the enemies alike of the Firbolg and Firmor, after he gets done describing these prehistoric beings that nobody can pin down, the Tuatha De Danann, the gods of the Gaels, he calls them, were the next to arrive. What is probably the earliest account tells us that they came from the sky. Remember that. Later versions, however, give them a habitation upon earth. Some say in the north, others in the southern islands of the world. Now, how can you get further apart than the north and the south? All I'm saying is, when some expert comes along and tells you, he knows. They had dwelled in four mythical cities called Thindius, Gorius, Murius, and Thalius, where they had learned poetry and magic. To the primitive mind, two not very dissimilar things. And whence they had brought to Ireland their four chief treasures. From Thindius came Nuada's sword, from whose stroke no one ever escaped or recovered. Hey, by the way, who carried that famous sword that David took from Goliath? Remember, it was put in the holy place, and when David was fleeing from Saul, he asked for a weapon, and that ratty priest that tattled on him to Saul's agents told him the only sword that was there, and he took it, and took it with him when he went into the land of the Philistines, Achish. And all of a sudden, that sword just sort of disappears, doesn't it? Huh? Anybody know where it went? I thought, well, don't do that. I don't know where it went. Yet. From glorious Lug's terrible lance, from Murius Dogda's cauldron, and from Phaleas the stone of fall, better known as the stone of destiny, which afterwards fell into the hands of the early kings of Ireland. Now, there's no British Israelite. There's no Christian. But he calls it myth, but he credits the stone of fall as being in the possession of the Tuatha De Danann, which translates literally into the tribe of Dan. Am I saying that's the Dan that was one of the 12 tribes that went into Israel? I ain't saying nothing yet. I just want to tell you, don't write off these lost tribes anywhere. According to the legend, it had been the magic property. It had the magic property of uttering a human cry when touched by the rightful king of Erin. Some have recognized in this marvelous stone the same rude block which Edward I brought from Scone in the year 1300 and placed in Westminster Abbey, where it now forms part of the coronation chair. It is, listen to me, Ken, you old Scotsman, you. It is, in heritage, that is, you're just a young kid, I know, but it is a curious fact that while Scottish legend asserts this stone to have come to Scotland from Ireland, Irish legend should also declare that it was taken from Ireland to Scotland. Isn't that interesting? Two separate countries in their legends independently asserting the same thing. The stone came from Ireland to Scotland, that's what the Irish say. And the stone came from Ireland to Scotland, that's what the Scottish say. This would seem to be conclusive evidence. But nonetheless, some other archaeologists, including Dr. W.F. Skene, who has published a monograph on the subject, that the stone of Scone and the stone of Tara were never the same. Well, whether the Tuatha, listen to this scholar, whether the Tuatha De Danann came from earth or heaven, they landed in a dense cloud upon the coast of Ireland on the mystic 1st of May without having been opposed or even noticed by the people whom it will be convenient to follow the manuscript authorities in calling the Firbolgs. The Tuatha De Danann advanced westward and reached a place called the Plain of the Sea. In Leinster, where the two armies met, the Firbolgs and the Tuatha De Danann, each sent out a warrior to parley. The two adversaries approached each other cautiously, their eyes peeping over the tops of their shields. Then coming gradually nearer, they spoke to one another, and the desire to examine one another's weapons made them almost friends. Almost a replay of David and Goliath, by the way, in this fight. The envoy of the Firbolgs looked with wonder at the beautifully shaped, thin, slender, long, sharp-pointed spears of the warrior of the Tuatha De Danann. They agreed to exchange weapons so that each side might, by examination, then goes on and tells the story of that battle. Then the Nuada, king of the Tuatha De Danann, sent an ambassador offering terms. In the battle, Nuada lost his hand, became silver hand as it was fixed, but because the Tuatha De Danann had in their law that no maimed or blemished person could serve as king, he had to step down. I wonder where that came from. The Tuatha De Danann become the leaders of Ireland now. These various prehistoric monuments, now we go past the cairns of stone, those mystery items all over Ireland. The various prehistoric monuments each have their still told story, and as Sir William Wilde, as he relates in his Luke Carib, was so impressed by the unexpected agreement between the details of the legendary battle as they, in archaeology, have uncovered the site of this battle between the Tuatha De Danann and the Firbolgs, as the Tuatha De Danann took over all but a fifth of Ireland, giving that fifth to the Firbolgs, and it's all written down to legend by these people who call it myths and fairy stories. But Sir William Wilde, the archaeologist who looked over the battlefield, read the descriptions, as he relates in his Luke Carib, was so impressed by the unexpected agreement between the details of the legendary battle as he read them in the ancient manuscript and the traditions still attaching to the mounds, circles, and cairns, But he tells us he could not help coming to the conclusion that the account was absolutely historical. Certainly the coincidences are curious. Now, why is there so much argument? Nobody knows. The history of the Irish. It's hidden. Certainly the coincidences are curious. His opinion was that the Firbolgs were a colony of the Belgae, and that the Tuatha De Danann were Danes. And Denmark simply means the mark of Dan. And if they had a king over him, he would have to be a displaced descendant of Judah, because they recognized the authority. If the tribe of Dan went anywhere, the only king they could recognize had to be a displaced son of Judah. Didn't have to come through Pharaoh. There had to be a son of Judah for them to recognize him as king. Or they were not following Scripture properly. They had no vowels in the Hebrew language. So you can put I, A, O, U in there, or E, and you will never know what the original meaning or spelling would be, because the original word only had the consonants. That means den, dan, done, or done, don, or den, are equal spellings of the same consonants for the tribe of Dan. Likewise, if you encounter a people who don't know you're supposed to supply the vowels, you can just have the D and the N with no vowel in between, like the Dnieper River. Now, am I saying that the tribe of Dan named all these places? I ain't saying anything yet. I'm just trying to pull your head apart. So, if you want to hear me preach things I'm explaining, turn on the other hours. I'm preaching around the clock. Well, I got pages and pages folded down here. I think I'll do something else. Now let's pull this other one out. This is the fairy tale. Now, all you folks in San Francisco, don't go try to buy this book. And don't move to a Celtic country. The fairy faith in Celtic countries. This is scholarly work. Now, to them, this guy is an important scientist. But believe it or not, he's about convinced that fairies exist. I mean, the fairy, fairy kind. The very, very fairy. Now, he talks about theories of the fairy faith. And to him, he believes in fairies. He traces them through Isle of Man, through Ireland and Scotland. I mean, he's got fairies everywhere. If anyone would know Ireland and test these influences, the influences which have been so fundamental in giving to the fairy faith of the past something more than mere beauty of romance, and attractive form, and something which even today is in the heroic ages is ever living and ever present in the sinners, where men of the second sight say that they see fairies in that strange state of subjectivity which the peasant calls fairyland. Let him stand on the hill of Tara, silently and alone at sunset, in the noonday, in the midst of a dark day. He's a scientist, friend. I mean, he wrote a monumental work. And here he comes. Chapter, section, second, the recorded fairy faith. The people of the goddess Dana, Tuatha De Danann, or the she, the way you pronounce S-I-D-H-E, she. So firm was the hold which the ethnic gods of Ireland had taken upon the imagination and spiritual sensibilities of our ancestors that even the monks and Christianized bards never thought of denying them. The people of the goddess Dana, or according to Darbois de Jubonville, the people, I guess he's a fairy too, the people of the god whose mother was called Dana are the Tuatha De Danann of the ancient mythology of Ireland. Now again, I want to bring you down to earth. What I'm after is I'm going to God's book and show you that God is faithful to His Word. And at the same time, I'm showing you it's solid ground to stand on. Some of these other things. The goddess Dana, called in genitive Danann in Middle Irish times, was named Bridget. And this goddess Bridget of the pagan Celts has been supplanted by the Christian Saint Bridget. And you know where the Maypole and May Day come from? The celebration of the landing of the Tuatha De Danann in Ireland. St. Bridget is a national saint, has been transferred from the pagan cult rendered to her predecessor. This pagan cult once bestowed on the spirits in wells and fountains. Has been transferred to Christian saints to whom the wells and fountains have been rededicated. Remember Christmas when I'm talking about saints? So the Saint Bridget, as a national saint, has been transferred, the pagan cult rendered to her predecessor. Thus, even yet, as in the case of the minor divinities of their sacred fountains, the Irish people, through their veneration for the good Saint Bridget, render homage to the divine mother of the people who bear her name Dana, who are the ever-living, invisible fairy people of modern Ireland. For when the sons of Meal, the ancestors of the Irish people, came to Ireland, they found the Tuatha De Danann in full possession of the country. The Tuatha De Danann then retired before the invaders without, however, giving up their sacred island. Assuming invisibility with the power of at any time reappearing in a human-like form before the children of the sons of Mill, the people of the goddess Dana became, in all the fairy folk, the she of Irish mythology and romance. Therefore it is that today Ireland contains two races, a race visible, which we call Celts, and a race invisible, which we call fairies. Irish seers say that they can behold the majestic, beautiful she, and according to them, the she are a race quite distinct from our own, just as living and possibly more powerful. The she, who are the gentry of the Ben Bulben country and of kindred elsewhere in Ireland, Scotland, and probably in most other countries as well, such as the invisible races of the Yosemite Valley, have been described more or less accurately by our peasant seer witness from County Sligo and from North and East Ireland. And on it goes. The recorded mythology and literature of ancient Ireland have very faithfully, for the most part, preserved to us clear pictures of the Tuatha De Danann. He calls them legends. The first one here is calling them gods. Now, what else we got here? Thought Perry had stole it for a moment. Here's the archaeology of Ireland that I was talking about the other night. Remember that? Had all these duns all over the place and dons all over the place. He's not sure. He just doesn't know, this archaeologist, whether the Tuatha De Danann are real or whether they're legendary. He doesn't take stand. He just knows they were there, somebody. And either there's a legend of gods that you got to sort out from the real, or there were people that had qualities so strange and different from the ones that were there that they were looked on as gods. According to one legend, he says, the Tuatha De Danann, demons, he calls them demons. Now, how far apart can you get from gods to demons now? According to one legend, the Tuatha De Danann demons came to Ireland from the northern islands of the world. Now, you got to remember, out of ancient hieroglyphics and out of all the earliest roots of ancient religions, the northern islands of the world were considered heaven. Now, these Tuatha De Danann, either northern islands of the world or the Great Northern Mountain, there is no necessity to visit as many English medieval churches as I have done to see how often the north door of a church is built up and how rare are the interments on the north side, essentially the devil's side. Complete turnaround in that myth to some who think God came from the north, and heaven's in the north. Now, this is the one I was the other night going through and showing you and teaching you Ogham. This is a book about Ogham. And then this book's just full of the Tuatha De Danann. All kinds of legends. And he's like a typical teacher. He doesn't take a stand. He just records the various viewpoints, the way I'm doing, like right now. Remember, he was talking about the Beaker folk who weren't supposed to be there, and then suddenly the Beaker folk were there. Can you imagine somebody just flipping by and going up past Z on the channel and they hit Scott when he's talking about the Beaker folk? I'm looking for something. All I want to say about this. You'll read fast if you stay with me. Okay, now he talks about the Latine culture. You don't have to go far on that to know it's a distortion of Latin. And he talks about the Scandinavian origins, but he keeps coming back to the Tuatha De Danann. Nobody can explain these Tuatha De Danann people. Who in the world are they? That's the general question that comes out. Were they gods? And how come they built so many forts? And all their forts were D-shaped. You got that circle right here, this finger here. Now you're on the wrong finger. There you go. Can you see that? D-shaped. Can you pick that up? And then I was showing you the other night how many of these places in Ireland are named Dans or Duns. Get your map of Ireland out. Here's Dun Angusa. Oh, I know, they can give you all kinds of explanations of why the Dun and Dan are in the Irish language. Dun, I can't pronounce their Onocht. Dun, spelled E-O-C-H-A-I-L, but it's O'Keel. Dun, Canar. How in the world do you get Dun Canar out of C-O-N-C-H-O-B-H-A-I-R? Now, why are these people building these forts? Listen close. Granted, the stones are the commonest objects of the bare Aran Islands. Why did any company think it was worth their while to build them in such desolate places? They're all over Ireland. The only reasonable answer that presents itself, that's the essential germ of the story transmitted to us by medieval scholastic historians. They were the last shelter of expelled refugees fleeing from some rapacious conqueror. driven step by step back to the western coast and to the islands beyond, they here made their final stand by no mere conventional metaphor, but in grim literal reality between the devil and the deep sea. Nothing but massacre or drowning in the Atlantic deeps awaited them outside their island fortress. In desperation, they heaped them up these vast walls to shield them from the fury of the tempest that had burst upon their country and their kindred. Why were they building these? You know, you find places like that in Palestine. Why were they building them? And why have they all got these derivative words? The end. Gone, done, done, then. Why are there so many of them? Now, what does Dan mean? Remember that? I told you the other night. Judge. Jordan is spreading judgment. What's the Irish word for judge? There you got it. Oh, just an accident. Interesting accident, isn't it? Let's get another one. Get another one. It's right here. Drop a little bomb on you. Drop a little bomb on you. You ready for this one? Just hold on a minute. About 500 ABC, 585. Harry got my tongue. About 585 BC, a notable man, this is settled history. About 585 BC, quit your laughing your head off in there in that room, Joe. About 585 BC, a notable man, an important personage, a patriarch, a saint. An essentially important someone, according to the various ways of putting it, came to Ulster, the most northern province of Ireland, accompanied by a princess, the daughter of an eastern king, and that, in company with them, was one Simon Brock, Brick, Brock, Barak, Barak, various ways in which the name is pronounced. Now, in the ancient biblical tongue that had no vowels, only consonants, Bethel would not have the consonant in between. You supply that. Baruch is like that. You have to supply. Now, these various names are one Simon Brock. This could just as easily be Brock. You can take the same four consonants and do them the same way. It could just as easily be Breck. It could just as easily be Barak. Now, when I was reading in Jeremiah the other night, I was going to point out to you the rest of the promises God gave to Jeremiah. He not only gave Jeremiah a promise, he gave Baruch a promise. He promised he'd spare him and his life would be a prey. And both of those men receive an unusual promise from God that wherever they go, they'll be spared. Now, 585 B.C., a notable man, an important personage, a patriarch, a saint, an essentially important someone, according to their various ways of putting it, came to Ulster, the most northern province of Ireland. You say, are you sure of this, friend? There ain't nobody going to be able to be sure of Irish history. That's the point I'm making. Anybody says this didn't happen, this is about as sure as any fact you can find in Irish history. And in company with them was one Simon Brock, Breck, Brock, Brick, Brock, as it is differently spelled, and that this royal party brought with them many remarkable things. You still with me? Let's pull another one out before I go back to that one. The story of the Irish race. Oh, by the way, how many of you know that in the national shield or emblem or whatever you call it of Ireland, the insignia of the kings of Ireland is the Harp of David? Everybody knows that. Huh? By Sumas McManus, assisted with several Irish scholars. Now, this is no Christian. This is no British Israelite. He loves Ireland. Attempt to sketch a rough and ready picture of the more prominent peaks that rise out of Ireland's past, the high spots of the story of our race. The story is developed with the object of interesting and informing the man who cannot or will not afford the time to read studiously. The writer is impelled to the compilation of this story of our race by the woeful lack of knowledge on the subject. To a large extent, the blame for American ignorance of Ireland's story rests upon the ignorance of our own exiles, the children of those exiles. See, what he said is, not too much is known. Yet, interestingly enough, from a certain point in Irish history, in graduate historiography classes at Chico State before I went to Stanford, told you the other night I had professors that belittled anybody that told anything strange. Wouldn't even look at them. Irish history has been confused and avoided because a lot of people don't want to face up to the facts that are there. So this old boy hit him in the teeth with it. For the inquiring reader's benefit, it may be useful to quote here a passage from an article on the ancient language, history, and literature of Ireland, which Dr. Douglas Hyde kindly contributed for this volume, but which was unfortunately received too late for inclusion. Says Dr. Hyde, "The numerous Irish annals in which the skeleton of Irish history is contained are valuable and ancient. We have, of course, no outside testimony by which we can verify their statements, but there is an abundance of internal testimony to show the accuracy with which they were handed down." Now, you're going to find that the Tuatha De Danann have a heritage of music, a heritage of poetry, a heritage of scribes who record with accuracy. But nobody wants to face up to anything other than the mythological existence of these Tuatha De Danann. But this solid Irish historian says, "The Annals of Ulster, to take one of several compilations of like character, treat of Ireland from about the year 444 and record numerous natural phenomena as they occurred. If it could be proved that these phenomena actually took place upon the very day described to them in the annals, we'd be able to conclude with something like certainty that they were actually written down at the time and recorded by eyewitnesses. The illustrious Bede, in recording the great eclipse of the sun," now Bede, the venerable Bede, is recognized by historians. "The illustrious Bede, in recording the great eclipse of the sun, which took place only 11 years before his own birth, is 2 days astray in his date, while the Irish annals give correctly not only the day, but the hour." That's how accurate they were. This proves that their compiler had access either to the original document or record of an eyewitness or to a copy of such document. These annals contain, between the end of the 5th century and the year 884, as many as 18 records of eclipses, comets, and such natural phenomena, and modern science, by calculating backwards, shows that all these records are absolutely correct both as to the day and the hour. From this, we can deduce without hesitation that at least from the 4th or 5th century, the Irish annals can be absolutely trusted. Now, what's he got to say about the Tuatha De Dananns? He starts out with early colonization. He says, the Irish race of today is popularly known as the Milesian race because the genuine Irish Celtic people were supposed to be descended from Milesius of Spain, whose sons, say the legendary accounts, invaded and possessed themselves of Ireland 1,000 years before Christ. Then down here some footnotes that show they don't agree on the dates, and not everybody agrees they came from there, and not everybody agrees they even existed. But as nearly as inaccurate to style the Irish people pure Milesian because the land was conquered and settled by the Milesians as it would be to call them Anglo-Norman. Now, the other guy, archaeologist, knows the Beaker people had to come from the Iberian Peninsula, and for years they thought there were no Beaker people there, and then they discovered there were. So now modern archaeology has proven the Milesians were probably people coming from the Iberian Peninsula. The races that occupied the land when the so-called Milesians came, chiefly the Firbolg, remember them? Firebolg, some people call them, and the Tuatha De Dananns were certainly not exterminated by the conquering Milesians. Those two peoples formed the basis of the future population, which had dominated and guided and had its characteristics molded by the far less numerous but more powerful Milesian aristocracy and soldiery. All three of these races, man, that's a far cry from demons and gods and fairies and myths, isn't it? Now, how many different sources do I have to go to let you know? Nobody's that sure. He's calling them races. All three of these races, however, were different tribes of the great Celtic family, who long ages before had separated from the main stem and in course of later centuries blended in again into one tribe of Gauls, three derivatives from one stream, which after winding their several ways across Europe from the east in Ireland turbulently met, and after eddying and surging tumultuously finally blended in amity and flowed onward in one great Gallic or Gaelic stream. The possession of the country was wrested. Well, of these three colonizations of Ireland, the Firbolg was the first. Legend says they came from Greece. In their possession of Ireland, the Firbolgs were disturbed by the descendants and depredations of African sea rovers, the Fomorians, who had a main stronghold on Tory Island off the northwest coast. But the possession of the country was wrested from the Firbolgs, and they were forced into partial serfdom by the Tuatha De Dananns, people of the goddess Dana, who arrived later. Totally unlike the uncultured Firbolgs, the Tuatha De Dananns were a capable and cultured, highly civilized people so skilled in the crafts, if not the arts, that the Firbolgs named them magicians, really is the common word. And in course of time, both the Firbolgs and the later coming Milesians created a mythology around these. The great Irish historiographer Eugene O'Curry says, the De Dananns were a people remarkable for their knowledge of the domestic, if not the higher arts of civilized life. Wonder who taught them. And he further adds, they were apparently more highly civilized than even their conquerors, the Milesians. In a famed battle at southern Moytura, it was that the Tuatha De Dananns met and overthrew the Firbolgs, and that's where I stopped on the other one. This guy takes some flat-out, unadulterated history. Eventually, let's talk about these Dananns. The legendary account of their coming to Ireland is as follows. Among other things, eventually they made land. Eber, with the survivors of his following, landing at Inversini in Bantry Bay. Eber? I'll go back to this other one, lay it on you. About 585 B.C., a notable man, an important personage, a patriarch, came to Ulster, the most northern province of Ireland, accompanied by a princess, the daughter of an eastern king, and that in company with them was one Simon Brock, Breck, Brock, Breck, Brock, as it is differently spelled, and that this royal party brought with them many remarkable things. Among these was the harp, an ark. Oh, my Lord. Going to have another movie now. Raiders of the Lost Ark. An ark and the wonderful stone called Leophel, or Stone of Destiny, of which I talked the other night. This eastern princess was married to King Hermon, usually with a silent H, Hermon, on condition made by this noble patriarch that came with the princess, that he should abandon his former religion and build a college for the prophets. Isn't that interesting? This Hermon did, and the name of the school was Mur Olam, which is the name both in Hebrew and Irish for school of the prophets. He also changed the name of his capital city, Lothair, sometimes spelled Kothair Kopha, to that of Tara. The name of this eastern princess is given as Tiatephi, and it is a well-known fact that the royal arms of Ireland contain the harp of David, and this has been so for 2,500 years. Furthermore, the crown worn by the sovereign of that hitherto unaccounted for kingdom. Historians are amazed at Ireland because there's a kingship suddenly lands full orbed with no historic antecedents, seemingly. The crown which was worn by the sovereign of that hitherto unaccounted for kingdom in Ireland had 12 points. How many tribes? How many sons? Now I want to tell you something else. Might as well go on to midnight. I went 2 o'clock to the pyramid. I've already lost people who don't want to think, so might as well stay with you people that know how to think. Find something else here. Morton W. Spencer says, quote, "It is an undeniable historical fact that about 580 B.C., that is the time very near to the captivity of the Jews in Babylon." Why are those Jews in Babylon? This is another book. Oh, here we are. This is Josephus Antiquities, the famous historian of the Jews. On the death of Darius, Xerxes took his son took the kingdom. Now there was in Babylon a righteous man and one that enjoyed a great reputation among the multitude. He was the principal priest of the people and his name was Esdras, Josephus' rendition of Ezra. He was very skillful in the laws of Moses and well acquainted with the king. He had determined to go up to Jerusalem and take with him some of those Jews that were in Babylon. Well, there's a long story of Josephus, how he got favor, got an epistle from the king giving him permission to go, which is recorded in our book of Ezra. Here Josephus records it and says he read the epistle of Babylon to those Jews that were there, but he kept the epistle itself and sent a copy of it to all those of his own nation that were in Media. Where's Media? Western Iran, east of the river Euphrates, east of the river Tigris, exactly where the 10 tribes had been moved in their bondage. Now Babylon has taken over the whole kingdom and conquered the Assyrian kingdom, so the 10 tribes to the north are still settled in the area where the Assyrians put them, east of the Euphrates in the Median area. Ezra, this isn't recorded in the biblical book of Ezra, Josephus records it. He kept the epistle and sent a copy to those. When these Jews had understood what piety the king had towards God and what kindness he had, the Jews responded. But the entire body, remember here, so you don't think I'm making it up, but then, the entire body of the people of Israel remained in that country. Wherefore there are but 2 tribes in Asia and Europe subject to the Romans. Because Josephus is writing at a time when the Romans have conquered the returned Jews who came back under Ezra and Nehemiah and have built the city and the temple, and the Jews conquered them. In Josephus' Antiquities of the Jews, he is their great historian. So he's pointing out in his time, as John, when he wrote Revelation, distinguishes between what was not, what was, what is, and what's yet to come. He points out parenthetically, there are but two tribes in Asia and Europe subject to the Romans, while the 10 tribes are beyond Euphrates till now. That's in the time of Josephus' writing, and are an immense multitude, and not to be estimated by numbers. Now those tribes way in the east. I'm going to find another one here. Oh, Thrace and the Thracians. Isn't that interesting? All these scientists, this is an archaeological study. And here's the map. Thrace occupied an ancient geography where Bulgaria is right now. And here's I'm so happy with my books. I mean, I can teach all night with an audience like Ethel. I want you to notice where these people are settling in Thrace. They come up over and out of the area of Turkey now. There's the Black Sea, and here's the Bulgarian area. In the time of Thrace, they call it Moesia. That strike any cognates with you? How about Hebrus, this river here? That strike any cognates? They had a strange god nobody could figure out. Nobody can figure out, with all their various messing around with heathen gods, they all had one uniform god they never ever adequately explained. He was almost a common god to all these various tribes, and they were tribal groups. Let me go back to the map. Here's all the tribes in that area, all over the place in that Turkish or Bulgarian area above the Grecian peninsula. But they had one god, Zalmoxis. Now, who's Zalmoxis? They had this tribe, Moesia. Just remember Zalmoxis. Martin W. Spencer says it's an undeniable historical fact that about 580... You got confused yet? You're not supposed to be confused. You're supposed to absorb or broaden in your mind that this may not be as simple as some people try to make it. But it's worth pointing out that God can keep it simple. I'll show you how it is. An undeniable historical fact about 580 B.C., that is the very time of the captivity of Jews in Babylon, that a princess from the east did arrive in the north of Ireland. Her name was Tephi, a pet name like Violet, denoting beauty and fragrance. Tia Tephi was her full name, found in Hebrew. The Tia, a little one, and Tephi answering to a surname, Toph, the root word, is used in many scriptures. Genesis 34:29 and Deuteronomy 1:39. Her names were interchangeably used as Tia Tophi, Tophase Tipi, the eastern princess, the daughter of Pharaoh, and Tia Tephi. Either of these served to identify her as the king's daughter. In Egypt, she was offered protection, and from her the city of Tophanhase, or Daphne, was named. Doubtless, and to this day, we're shown the site of the palace of the Jew's daughter by the Arabs. The fact that she fled the country is still preserved in her name, Tara, meaning one banished or flight. The name of Pharaoh is neither a given nor a surname, but it's the Egyptian name for a king or monarch. It's not a name. It means king or monarch. The very fact that Irish historians call Tia Tephi the daughter of Pharaoh is proof that they knew her as the king's daughter. Also, this name, king's daughter, crops up in other ways. There's still other facts connected with the arrival of this princess in Ireland, which, as we consider them, will strengthen our faith more and more. That there is a mystery here worth searching after. Tia Tephi was accompanied by an aged guardian who was called Olamphala, more Hebrew words which mean revealer or prophet. The prophet was accompanied by a man who was his scribe, whom the chronicles of Ireland call Brug or Brook. They brought with themselves this strange rock. On the occasion, I read you this the other night, of Queen Victoria's coronation, June 28, 1837, an article appeared in the London Sun which gives a description of the coronation chair and the coronation stone as follows. This chair, commonly called St. Edward's chair, is an ancient seat of solid hardwood. Now, we're going to go look at that, aren't we, in Westminster Abbey, Kent? This chair, commonly called St. Edward's chair, is an ancient seat of solid hardwood with backs and sides of the same, variously painted, in which the kings of Scotland were in former periods constantly crowned. But having been brought out of the kingdom by Edward I in the year 1296, after he had totally overcome John Balliol, King of Scots, it has ever since remained in the Abbey of Westminster, and has been the chair in which the succeeding kings, this is quoting from the London Sun, the succeeding kings and queens of this realm have been inaugurated. It is in height 6 feet and 7 inches, in breadth at the bottom 38 inches, in depth 24 inches, from the seat to the bottom is 25 inches. The breadth of the seat within the sides is 28 inches and the depth 18 inches. At 9 inches from the ground is a board supported at four corners by as many lions. Between the seat and this board is enclosed a stone, commonly called Jacob's, or the fatal marble stone, which is an oblong of about 22 inches in length, 13 inches broad, 11 inches deep, of a steel color mixed with some veins of red. History relates that it is the stone whereon the patriarch Jacob laid his head in the plains of Luz. This, as you see, was published more than 60 years ago, before it was thought possible that the Anglo-Saxons were the descendants of Joseph or in any way connected to any of these lost tribes. This article further says, quote, this stone was conveyed into Ireland by way of Spain about 700 years before Christ. From there it was taken into Scotland by King Fergus about 370 years later. And in the year 350 B.C., it was placed in the Abbey of Scone by King Kenneth, who caused a prophetical verse to be engraved upon it, of which the following is a translation. Should fate not fail where'er this stone is found, the Scots shall monarch of that realm be crowned. This antique regal chair, still quoting from the London paper, having together with the golden scepter and crown of Scotland been solemnly offered by King Edward I to St. Edward the Confessor in the year 1297, from whence it derives the appellation of St. Edward's Chair, has ever since been kept in the chapel, called by his name, with a tablet affixed to it, whereon several Latin verses are written in old English characters. The stone maintains its usual place under the seat of the chair. Prior to the time that King Kenneth had his verse engraved on that coronation stone, there was a prophetic verse which had attached itself to it, which Sir Walter Scott has rendered, one word accepted, as follows. Unless the fates of faithless groan and prophet's voice be vain, where'er is found this sacred stone, the wanderer's race shall reign. Dean Stanley says it's the chief object of attraction to this day to the innumerable visitors to the Abbey, and is probably that ancient Irish monument of the empire known as the Coronation Stone. He calls it a precious relic and says that King Edward said that it is the one primeval monument which binds together the whole empire. Dean Stanley further adds, the iron rings, the battered surface, the crack, which has all but rent its solid mass asunder, bear witness to a long migration. It is thus embedded in the heart of the English monarchy, the element of poetic, patriarchal, heathen times, which, like the threshing floor bought by King David in the midst of the Temple of Solomon, carries back our thoughts to the races and customs now almost extinct. This is Dean Stanley, not a British Israelite. A link which unites the throne of England with the traditions of Tara and Iona, and connects the charm of our complex civilization with the favors of Mother Earth, the stocks and stones of savage nature. Faithful or foolish, the sentiment of the nation has, through 300 generations of living men, made it felt that Jacob's pillar stone was a thing worth dying for in battle. By the Treaty of Northampton in 1328, the emeralds, pearls, and rubies were carried off without a murmur. But the ragged old stone? Oh no, the Londoners would have died for that. The stone of stone, on which it was the custom for the kings of Scotland to be set at their coronation, the Londoners would on no account suffer to be sent away. Dr. Poole says, this stone is a dull, reddish, or purplish sandstone with a few small embedded pebbles. One of these is quartz, two others of a dark material. The rock is calcareous and is of that kind which masons call freestone. Chisel marks are visible on one or more of its sides. There is no rock of this kind in England, Ireland, or Scotland. But the Reverend Canon Tristram says that there is a stratum of sandstone near the Dead Sea just like this stone, which by the English people is called Jacob's Pillow Stone. This stone is called by the Irish and by the Scotch, Leofail, and the Stone of Destiny. The Irish, in Irish, Leah is stone and Fail is fate, hence the Stone of Fate or the Stone of Destiny. But it is that only because it is called Jacob's Pillar Stone. This is the reason that Tiatephi was called the daughter of God's house. Log, a lug, Celtic for God, and add a house, hence the word Lugad. Amergin, chief baird to the King Dermod, monarch of Ireland in the 6th century, in the notes of the Annals of the Four Masters, refers to Tiatephi as follows. A rampart was raised around her house for Tia, the daughter of Lughad. She was buried outside in her mound, and from her it was named Tiamur. Her destiny then called the daughter of God's house, because she brought with herself this stone given divine attributes called by Jacob the house of God, and it is called to this day by the English Jacob's Pillar Stone. Now, those facts, folks, I ain't saying where it came from, but they sure didn't carry it with those iron rings from Ireland to Scotland or to England. So who carried it? Because the iron rings had got the wear, and it's dated back into antiquity. And where in the world we've got the Tuatha De Danann that come in the Celtic invasion from the Far East across Europe, from Denmark, as the historian there finally concluded, the Firbolgs are the Belgi, and the Tuatha De Danann are the Danes. And then somewhere coming up by the Iberian Peninsula comes someone, a strange man, in 580 BC, 585 BC, with a name in Irish that means prophet, with a servant or scribe, Baruch or Barak or Bluck, and with a princess called King's Daughter, a harp, and a strange stone. Now, how in the world did the Tuatha De Danann that came across Europe as part of the Celtic invasion, and these people meet up, and what's the explanation for all these strange things? I'm getting there. And how come it's been cloaked in mystery for so many centuries? There are people who say that one of the applications of Isaiah 40, where I started tonight, is because God commanded it. After being driven and building their round forts to protect themselves and their high civilization, driven to the isles of the sea, God's command is, because he's certainly talking as the one who brought him from the east and raised up a righteous man from the east, by the way. The one who brought him there after their wanderings, as inscribed in that poem of Sir Walter Scott that I quoted earlier, the wandering ones, said, keep silence before me, O islands, and let the people renew their strength. You say, is that the interpretation of Isaiah 40? I didn't say that. I said, some say it. I'll get to it. I'll tell you what I think. Isn't this fun? Huh?